I'm an addict named Sam.
Sam.
Yeah, all right. It's truly by the grace of God and Narcotics Anonymous that I'm alive and clean. It's a distinct honor and a privilege to be up here, and I want to thank the program committee for considering me for this particular task. You know, it's special enough being in an event held by Narcotics Anonymous to walk through this hotel this weekend and feel the love and see people embrace that they don't even know, help each other, see evidence of a loving God walking through this hotel all weekend long. Man, that's phenomenal. To add on to that particular blessing, I got some very special people up here with me tonight. My fiance is here. Chris, I love you dearly. My big sister is here with her husband and my niece, Chelsea. Got a couple of very special friends up here, Sheila and Don. Got a sponsee that made it, Big Gare. Love you, man. And I'm supposed to mention one particular person twice so people can go back and report to New Haven that I said their name. Stephen I am, Stephen I am. Okay, I'm done. Before I embark upon any part of my journey, I'd like to come from our literature so I can get in touch with a loving God. Let that person in, please. Come on, you're holding us up. Come on now. I like to come from our text so I can get in touch with a loving God and I can share a message of Narcotics Anonymous instead of the mess of me. Okay? This is from We Do Recover, page 86. Recovery begins with surrender. From that point, each of us is reminded that a day clean is a day one. In Narcotics Anonymous, our attitudes, thoughts, and reactions change. We come to realize that we are not alien and begin to understand and accept who we are. Paragraph on the bottom of page 86. Most addicts resist recovery, and the program we share with them interferes with their using. If newcomers tell us that they can continue to use drugs in any form and suffer no ill effects, there are two ways we can look at it. The first possibility is that they're not addicts. The other is that the disease has not become apparent to them and they are still denying their addiction. Addiction and withdrawal distort rational thought. And newcomers usually focus on differences rather than similarities. They look for ways to disprove the evidence of addiction or disqualify themselves from recovery. And finally, in our recovery, we find it essential to accept reality. Once we can do this, we do not find it necessary to use drugs in an attempt to change our perceptions. Without drugs, we have a chance to begin functioning as useful human beings if we accept ourselves and the world exactly as it is. Again, I'm an addict. My name is Sam. excuse me. I'm going to give you a little brief history so you can get to know me a little bit. I don't do a real extensive drug-a-log. I truly believe if your story is not enough to keep you here, then you need to keep coming. My story keeps me here. Born and raised in New Haven, Connecticut, second oldest of four children. My mom basically raised us by herself. Pop left when I was about six or seven. I'm not quite sure which. And my mom did a heck of a job raising four kids by herself. For the first 11 years of my life, I was the only boy in the house. I need to tell you that was tough. my older sister, who's a very loving and caring and gentle person today, was a bully when we were growing up. I think from a very early age, I started taking on stuff that wasn't mine, and started to feel like I didn't fit in anywhere in my life. excuse me. Like, there were certain things. Okay, I need some more water? Okay. Thank you. There were certain things that happened in our life that didn't have distinct effects on me until later on. Like, for instance, I didn't know we were poor until somebody told us. I didn't know it wasn't abnormal not to have your father in the house until I ran into some friends whose father stayed at home. I practiced the art of fantasy from a very early age. I would create worlds where I was comfortable and where I fit in and where I ran things. It's funny, my mom would always give us a choice when we were about to be punished. I mean, my sister laughed about this often. Excuse me. And the choice was you can get your butt whipped or you can go in your room. I'm not a pain person. I would choose my room all the time. And in the prospect of doing that, I started, like, becoming real comfortable being alone and isolating. My sister, she was much braver than I was, and she would take the butt whipping and go outside. And I would watch the festivities from my window and just, you know, do my time. I had a very active imagination as a kid. I would spend hours alone. Anybody who's about the same age I am, I'm about 40 years old, and I had a bag of green army men. You guys remember those, right? I mean, I've come to realize now in retrospect I was anal from a very early age. Identification, huh? I would spend hours lining them up on the floor. And I mean, they were meticulously lined up where I can see from one helmet all the same ones in a row. And I would take the books in my room and I would create a city. And I would drive my Hot Wheels around the books. Very active imagination. It kept me safe from the world. I used to say my family was dysfunctional, but that's not the case. I had a very loving family. We dealt with what we could with the best of what we had. I picked up for the very first time when I was 10 years old. And it wasn't any particular one reason other than opportunity. My cousin and myself were hanging over his older sister's house, and she used to do dope. And we thought it was so cool to watch them. We would go over her house in Trade Union Projects back in the day, and they would do dope and play chess. And we thought that was so cool. See, we didn't know they weren't intensely studying the board. That they were in these deep nods, you know. And they would sit there and it would look just so cool. And we would hang around them and try to be like them. And she asked us one day to deliver a package across town, and we did. And the person we gave the package to gave us a bag of weed. It was about an ounce of weed, 5 nickel bags, and 11 joints. I remember it like it was yesterday. We smoked the 11 joints, all worldly 10 years old of us. Gave away the 5 nickels so somebody can roll the rest of the ounce for us. And that was the beginning. Excuse me. Through my act of addiction, through my life, when I say I don't feel like I fit in, let me qualify that for a little bit. I was a young, skinny, narrow-headed, buck-toothed little boy. Okay? Had no fight game, had no sports acumen whatsoever. My biggest weapon was my brain. But back in my neighborhood, if you was too smart, you got your behind whooped. So I learned how to fit in and become a chameleon at an early age. And when the drugs came onto the scene, I was more adaptable at becoming part of my new environment. It wasn't unusual for us to go to church on Sunday and then do Sunday school, because my grandfather was a Baptist minister. And if he were to see me today, he would just shake his head and laugh, because a very powerful man in my life. We would go to church, do Sunday school. Then there would be a break between Sunday school and the sermon, and we would go on Congress Avenue and find some weed, smoke it, and go back to church. The whole time that I sat in the choir stand or in the pew, I was waiting for the lightning bolt to happen, because I knew that God saw me go on Congress Avenue, and he was not going to tolerate me going high into his house. I was a smart kid, sometimes to my own detriment. I excelled in school. I loved learning. I loved books. And my mom was an advocate for education. See, I didn't know until I got older that my mom had a sixth grade education. There was no way you would have known. The woman would read 5 or 6 books a week. We would come home and she'd be on that couch with her glasses on her nose, book wide open, intently reading that book. And my first book I read was by Leon Uris. My mom was reading it and she wouldn't put it down. I asked her, could I read it, when she got done, and that's what propelled my love of reading. So I was a pretty smart kid. And the irony of, like, using at such an early age was, when I wasn't high, people thought something was wrong with me. When I was high, they thought I was acting normal. And, you know, people say that marijuana is a gateway drug. I don't know about any kind of gateways. I know if you choose a particular path in your life, that there's consequences. And that it was only a matter of time that it stopped working and I had to seek something else. I would love to sit here and tell you that during the first 8 or 9 years of active using, my life was unmanageable, but it wasn't. I was able to have a level of control and maintain that for a while, and I believe that's the love affair that my disease needs me to have to finally get me. At the ripe old age of 17, 18 years old, at 17, my mom and I had a discussion one time, because I had snuck out, went over to some girl's house, stayed all night, and I usually would be able to get home before she woke up, you know, and I would play it off, because one time she caught me and I was downstairs, so I acted like I had fallen asleep on the couch, which she hated, and I'd rather take that than if she had caught me actually sneaking in. But she caught me sneaking in one time, and she told me, if you can't live by my rules, you got to leave, and, you know, and I was all worldly at 17, 18 years old, so I left. Mind you, I did not go on my own. I went to my grandmother's house. Stop playing. I was still in school. I was working full-time, smoking, drinking, doing what was necessary to maintain whatever lifestyle I had told myself was necessary to have. I ran into my uncle one day, and my uncle was a professional booster. He could steal the stink out of dew, you know what I mean? And he asked me if I wanted to go downtown with him. He was going to teach me how to shoplift.
I relate to that, too.
I see that, yeah. We got to talk when I get done, yeah. Okay. And he took me down to this store called Edward Malley's, which is no longer open in New Haven. And he says, okay, what you do is you take the shirt and you fold it and you put it in the front of your pants and you pull your shirt over it and you walk out. Sounded simple enough. I had never done anything like that before. And I picked this god-awful, ugly shirt. It was a velour shirt. It was the middle of the summer. What was wrong with me? It was beige with brown sleeves. It was horrible. And I folded this thing up and I stuck it in my pants. And from the moment I hid this shirt, I felt totally self-conscious, like somebody was watching. And I made it to the door, and as I got to the door, the security guard put his hand on my shoulder, and I actually felt relieved to have gotten caught. Because I don't know about you guys, once I get away with something, I'm more compelled to do it again. And they led me downstairs in the basement to the security area, and as I was going downstairs, my uncle's walking across the store with a rack of clothes. Whole rack. And even though I was angry that he had used me, I was sort of feeling good about myself because it was me he used, if that makes any sense. Went in lockup, went in front of a judge a few days later, and he says, "What's going to keep me from putting you in jail?" I said, "If you let me go, I'll join the military." He said, "You bring back your induction papers and you're free." So I joined the military. Excuse me. Now, if you're an addict like me, and you know, we hate structure. We hate rules. We hate accountability. I don't think Uncle Sam was necessarily a wise choice because of those three things. I went into the Air Force. I became a police officer. Yeah, I know, that's the irony. Other parts of my disease manifested itself. I became very adept at lying, manipulating, maneuvering things around to get my way. I did benefit a little bit from the military because I learned some structure, but I rebelled against everything. In basic training, they used to give you these two little pieces of paper that you would stick in your front lapel. And anytime you got in trouble, any officer over your rank can pull a piece of paper, write down the infraction, put it back in your pocket. You had to turn it into your drill instructor at the end of the day. By the second week, they took my two sheets of paper and gave me a pad. Didn't necessarily fit in there either. Did the military. Met a woman when I was about 19 years old. Fell into infatuation, fell in love, fell into something. I'm not sure what it was, but she was one of the first women in my life that made me feel like I was wanted and loved and appreciated, I mean, besides my family. And we hit it off, and we talked about getting married. And I found out she was pregnant. And I was like just overjoyed, and I was gonna go back to Ohio and, you know, ask her parents for her hand in marriage. And her mother called me and says, "I don't want you to see my daughter ever again." And she proceeded to call my first sergeant and lay down some allegations. And they called me in the office and told me that if I go to Ohio for the duration I'm in the military, that I end up in jail. So I couldn't go see her anymore. I have a daughter who I have yet to be blessed to see. There's a little gaping hole in my heart that's only going to be filled by this child. Needless to say that it already fed an abandonment issue that was already nurturing itself inside my spirit. And I believe that was the time in my life when I started really just not having respect for relationships, period. Came home on leave, met my wife through my baby sister, got married, got kicked out of the military in 1984. For a long time, my mom believed I made the decision to leave. Uncle Sam sort of helped me with that. Came home. Got married, beautiful young lady. She truly didn't deserve what I put her through. And she surely wasn't looking to go where I dragged her through. We were a cute little couple. That little one-bedroom apartment, little hoopty, you know. Two decent jobs, no children, and the promise of a fulfilling life was there because I was still maintaining a certain level with my disease. My buddy came home from the military about 6 months after I did, and when I say my buddy, I'm talking about we've been friends since we were 10 years old. I'm talking about we did a lot of things together, including getting clean and staying clean. My best friend has 16 years also. But I'm telling you that we had to develop a friendship based upon something else other than what we were doing. He came home. I'm married. He's not. We hung out. Bad idea. I got reintroduced to cocaine one night we were hanging out. And in the beginning, that love affair was there again, you know what I'm saying? The ability to control it, to take a little bit and fold the bill up and put it away and all the stuff that the disease allows you to think you can do. And one night, we decided to go over to somebody's house that he knew, and this guy took my drugs and put it in this vial, poured some water in there, and I was ready to kill him. So I had no idea what he was doing with my stuff. And he commenced to preparing it, and it's the very first time I freebased. I need to tell you, every other aspect of my disease allowed me a honeymoon. This did not. I need to tell you that there wasn't that gradual progression. It was straight to, while we were doing it, can we get some more? I need to tell you that up until that point, I had, 12 years of active addiction with some level of control, and when the crack cocaine hit my life, there was no control. Period, the end, if I may borrow Sheila's favorite saying. The digression. By this time in my life, I had I was working at the Connecticut State Law Library. I was wearing a shirt and tie every day. Yeah, I was looking good, too. I had a little briefcase. You know, life was cool. People respected me. My peers were like, oh, you're doing so well. And, you know, as an addict, we like that adulation, even when we don't feel it in here. I worked with two very lovely women. They were older white women, and they were very naive. And when I mean naive, I mean any excuse I gave them, they ate. Toward the 3 years from the beginning to the end, man, it got ugly. It got ugly quick. You know, I mean, you get to that point, you're not paying bills anymore. You're not putting food in the refrigerator. You're not accountable to the person that says they love you. So we had no cable, no lights, no gas. Not a motor car, no even luxury. You know the deal, right? It got to the point where the only time I treated her with any kind of respect was Thursday night because she got paid on Fridays. And the other 5 days, 6 days out of the week, she was a piece of furniture. It got to the point where our landlord would have to camp out on the front door to have any hopes of getting any kind of rent. And by the time he finally caught up with me, he evicted our butts. Go figure. You know, it was only like 7 or 8 months that we didn't pay. moved in with my mom. My mother was always there. In whatever capacity she wanted to be, she was always there. And she allowed us to move in, and there were some stipulations, of course. Because by this time, I think everybody pretty much knew I had a problem but me. And the ability to hide it was no longer apparent in my life. I'm talking about that when I went into treatment in 1987, I weighed 105 pounds soaking wet. I'm talking about I was 25 years old wearing a size 26 pant. I'm talking about that I was wearing shirts that I had bought when I had some weight and the collar was bunched up. I'm talking about the Sinbad belt, you know, the pull and poke because you're losing the weight. I'm talking about I lost the ability to look at myself in the mirror because I knew how bad I looked. I knew how bad I felt. I think somewhere around maybe a year to 18 months that before I stopped, I truly stopped getting high. And there were a couple attempts at stopping the using. And the most frightening thing I had ever witnessed in my life was the desire to want to stop using and the inability to stop. I white-knuckled it for 3 days one time. And I'm sitting around the house and I'm making everybody miserable. Because, you know, an addict who wants to use, who decides to try not to use on their own, subjects anybody in their path to the pain. And by the third day, my wife said, please go get high. It may sound funny, but it was the most frightening thing she ever said out of her mouth. Toward the living with my mom, the stipulation was, you give me your bank book. This is back before ATMs, cell phones that can fit in the pocket, instant availability to meetings, all that good stuff. So hand her the check, make the deposit, give her the bank book. I knew I was in trouble when I threatened her life for my bank book because she wouldn't give it to me one night, and I threatened to hurt her. There comes a distinct time in every addict's life when one particular event becomes undeniably clear that there's something wrong. That was the event for me. Much more abuse, much more insanity. I mean, we're talking about a disease that tells you it's okay to sweep the rug with your fingers and smoke plaster of Paris, rice chips, straw paper, anything that was white that would fit in the pipe. We're talking about a disease that had me sitting in the same spot for 8 to 12 hours at a time, afraid to go to the bathroom because I may miss the next one. We're talking about a disease that had me climbing in the second floor of my mother's apartment when I had the key to the front door because my brain told me I didn't want to be seen sneaking in. After a second failed suicide attempt, I came home one morning and I said the three words that most addicts say right before this process starts for us, I need help. And it was like a fire drill in my house. My mom was on the phone making phone calls. My wife was throwing clothes in the suitcase. They were ready for this. And I went up to a treatment facility up in Portland, Connecticut. I didn't even know we had a Portland, Connecticut. And I learned about my disease. The first 2 weeks I was there, I was a professional patient. And I was going around the facility telling everybody else how to change their life. I told you I was intelligent. I told you intelligence impedes an addict's ability to hear rational, simple messages. Okay? And my counselor finally told me I'm not getting a check. I may as well just be a patient. And I got out, and I stayed clean for 6 months. And I changed absolutely nothing, except the fact that I did not use. I got into an outside relationship with another addict that was clean. I picked this particular addict up at a drug treatment facility that specialized in mental illness. The funny thing about it is that the people in my home area knew about her, and they kept saying, you're going to use. And I kept saying, nah, it's all right. We just hang out. We go to meetings. You know, we do our thing. We cool. But the longer we stayed in that dysfunctional relationship, and it was dysfunctional because you had two addicts with no direction. Okay? And the longer we stayed in that relationship, the further we had to go to hit meetings because we had to end up somewhere where no one knew us so we can feel somewhat normal. One night after dropping her off and riding around, because one of the funny things that happens when you do things you ain't supposed to be doing, you don't feel good on the inside. And I couldn't make that revelation about I'm not feeling good. Maybe if I do something different, I'll feel better. I couldn't make that connection. So I'm riding around. I didn't want to go home. And I ran into an old friend of mine who lived out, my mom used to stay at. And he wanted to ride home. And I gave him a ride home. He was actively using. There was no guesstimation. He had the smell, the look, the walk, the act. And I dropped him off, and he invited me in. I said, it's cool, I'm in recovery. And I went in, and it was a typical house of people who used. And you know, it was a scurrying because he was the runner. And when he got in, everybody scurried around him and the activity started. And, you know, addicts in the beginning of using for any particular session are usually generous. You know what I mean? And they offered some. Would you like some? No, thanks. I'm in recovery. And I sat there and I watched him use. Now, you take a bad situation and you add some fuel to the fire. And he went out to make another run, and this young lady that was in there getting high said, listen, I'm going over to my sister's house. Do you want to join us? Mm-hmm. So I go across town, and they commence with the ritual, and they offer, and I said, no, thank you. I'm in recovery. You guys go ahead. Like I'm at a dinner table saying I had enough. Thank you, please. Before that night was over, I was using. See, there's no way an addict who seeks recovery in Narcotics Anonymous can expose themselves to the lifestyle and not be affected by it. There's no way. And I got high for that weekend. I called my mother up. I said, Ma, I used again. I don't know what to do. She said, take your stupid ass to a meeting, and she hung up on me. So I surrendered, and I went to a meeting, and I got that white keychain. I would love to sit up here and tell you that I was full of love, hope, honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, service. Not the case. The one thing that kept me clean for about the first 5 or 6 years was pure rebellion because people said I wouldn't stay clean. You want to get an addict to do something? Tell them they can't. That's why I don't tell anybody you can't get in a relationship. Why send them there? The sad part about that is that, you know, there's certain people in here that are just starting this journey and understand that if you start this journey without the proper equipment, all you do is wander lost. Please understand that. And that's what I did for 6 years. And it affects every area of your life, just like active addiction affects every area of your life and everyone who comes into your life. So does not recovering. See, I believe that my marriage stopped because I couldn't bring recovery home. I believe that she got tired of being a widow to my disease and then a widow to my recovery. See, I believe that she got to a point where she thought that it's that old Ann Landers thing. If you ever read Ann Landers and it's about a relationship, Ann asks that same question, are you better off with or without? And she decided she was better off without. And I can't blame her. I mean, what difference was it? When I was using, I was out all night, coming home all different kinds of hours. When I got clean, and let me tell you, in early recovery back in the Connecticut area, you had to travel to hit meetings, much like you guys do up here now, and I commend you for that, because I know the effort that it takes to do that. And we would pile up in cars and go all over the state of Connecticut to hit meetings. And I don't know about you guys, but as a recovering addict or an abstinent addict in that particular time, I discovered the joy of coffee. You ever want to know if you're around some addicts, watch them drink coffee. And I mean, I would go to work, have a cup of coffee in the morning, have a cup at the coffee break, go home, dress for a meeting, get a cup of coffee on the way to the meeting, get to the meeting, drink coffee, after the meeting, go out with addicts and have coffee. And wonder why I never got no sleep. But in the process of doing all that, there were particular signs when she was giving me that I wasn't reading that were stating, like, why can't you stay home? Why can't you be a part of the house? And my response was, you need to be glad I'm clean. Let me tell you something. That does not equate to a healthy relationship. I got to a point in my abstinence where I divorced myself from Narcotics Anonymous. I was tired of y'all. I was tired of the advice. I was tired of going to meetings where people were happy and chipper and their lives were changing. And because this is at a point where the anger was so bad that I was going to business meetings, taking them hostage. Like there would be 15 addicts on one side of the issue, and that one lone one would be me. I'm talking about I was going to meetings and raising my hand, and the chairperson would seek someone else to call on. I'm talking about that when I got separated in 94, had about 6 years clean. And for the duration that I got separated, man, I would come home and I would smell my family. You know, because a certain home, when you develop that home as a family, it has an aura and a feel and a spirit and a smell to it. And I would come home and it wouldn't be there because they had left. And I called my mom again. And I said, Mommy, I can't stay here by myself no more. It's killing me. You know, God works the way he works. And I don't truly understand his will. And I'm not supposed to. I'm just supposed to follow it. And she was suffering from the empty nest syndrome. My sister had moved down to Virginia. My baby sister had gotten married. My brother got locked up or was on his way to getting locked up. So she needed somebody to take care of. So God got us together. What I wasn't aware of, that was going to be the last 18 months of her life. My mom was diagnosed with a terminal illness. And the kind of strength this woman has, if I can just get 10% of it, man, she made her doctor promise not to tell us anything. And she went about her life as if nothing was wrong. And I'm talking about, I was working for a company that had me on call, and I would like, that's why I was a little familiar with Vermont, because the area that we covered was Newington, Connecticut to Brattleboro, Vermont. And I would get a call and go get the truck and deliver the equipment and come back home and peel off clothes and collapse across the bed and get up in the morning. Those clothes were cleaned and folded. I mean, like, she took care of me. And I realized that by being there, I gave her something to love. I remember when I started noticing that she was having difficulty getting around. And I sort of said, Ma, you need to get up out of here, because she had an upstairs, downstairs, and her mobility wasn't what it used to be. And she says, okay, I'll get my place when you get your place. That was my mom. She thought about everybody else first. And she knew it was time for me to move on. So I got my apartment, and she got her place over on Park Street, and I helped her move over there. And I would check up on her regularly. And, I mean, we had a conversation one day. I'm like, Mom, there's certain things I don't know how to cook that I want you to teach me how to cook. And the last thing we were supposed to cook was collard greens. Now, I can do the macaroni and cheese. And I'm all right with turkey a little bit. But I couldn't master them collard greens. And she was like, okay, you just Just get them and bring them on over, and I'll show you how to cook them. We were supposed to get together that Friday, but she wasn't feeling real well. And I said, well, listen, you go ahead and get your rest, Mom, and I'll just I'll call you tomorrow, see how you're doing. And the same thing happened Saturday, and I said, well, I'm just going to let her rest, and I'll call her Monday and find out how she's doing. I came home Monday on my lunch break. I was into Jerry Springer back then. I told you I was angry. And this is back when they were still allowed to fight. And I'm sitting there, because one of my favorite lunches, man, is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a bowl of soup. That still just moves me sometimes. And I'm sitting there having my sandwich and soup, and the phone rings, and it's my uncle. And he says, how you doing? I'm like, I'm all right. You know, because my family rarely calls me. So, and he's like, well, Mom's gone. I said, yeah, well, Mom had an appointment. She'll probably be back later. He says, no, you don't understand. Mommy's gone. When it finally dawned on me, I can't sit up here and tell you how I made it across town because I don't know. I can tell you that when I got to the apartment building and I went upstairs, there was a police officer in the hallway. And my mom was laying across her bed. And I got to tell you, that was the blackest moment in my life. See, I didn't really feel abandoned by my father until later on in my life, like I do now. But I felt so alone. The one person that I could always count on was my mom. And I made two of the most difficult phone calls I ever had to make in my life. And I called my sisters. And I told them what happened. And I got to tell you that my sister made me promise not to do anything until she got up from Virginia. And I gave her my word that I wouldn't. And I got to tell you, those were the hardest 2 days of my life. Because I did not think about using. I did not contemplate using. I wanted to use. I knew nothing else could give me a temporary relief to the pain I was feeling. I'm talking about with 7 years clean, man. I had amassed some stuff, you know. Because when you stop using, man, you do stupid things like save money and have furniture and food, you know. And I was living like four blocks away from one of the hottest cocaine areas in our city. And I was walking around the house, man, just assessing the valuables. Because I was going to use. And as I was gathering up TVs and stereo and had a big old change jar that was almost full and I had a bank account with a little bit of money in there and I was contemplating how I can get all that stuff together, man, so I can get rid of this pain. And I lived in an apartment that had the doorbell, those types that as long as you push it, it would ring. And somebody was ringing my doorbell. I need to tell you, man, that I was so hurt that I had homicidal thoughts. Like if the wrong person crossed my path, I was taking them out. So here's this person on my doorbell, and they're not letting go of the doorbell. And I pick up this Louisville Slugger, right? Because I'm going to do them. Whoever it is, I'm going to do them. And I open the door, and this brother that I know walked in my house. Pushed me to the side, bat and all. Walked into my apartment, went in my kitchen, popped some popcorn, put it in a bowl, went in my living room, sat down, popped a video in the VCR, and commenced to watching The King of New York. And I'm standing by the couch with this bat in my hand, and I'm looking at him, and I'm looking at the TV, and I'm looking at him, and finally it dawned on me how stupid I looked. And I sat down with him and I watched that movie. After the movie was over, he gets up, cleans out the bowl, rewinds his tape, and leaves. I need to tell you, this brother never said a word. And when he left my house, the desire to use was gone. Don't tell me there's not a loving God working in my life. Suddenly it dawned on me that the only way I was going to get through this was with my family and with Narcotics Anonymous. I went to a few meetings and I asked for help, and the response was phenomenal. And during this time, I ran into an old friend that I went to treatment with, and we were both speaking at a speaker jam. And it was funny, I only got asked to speak at events where anger was like a great topic. So we decided we were going to hang out again because we hadn't seen each other in years, and every time we got together, we had this path that we walked. And I started hanging up in Hartford, and I was going to Hartford 4 or 5 times a week for meetings. And I ran into this gentleman, older gentleman, a little short. Man, if he ain't a retread from the 70s, ain't nobody is. My sponsor still has leisure suits in his closet. And for 8 months, I watched this man. For those of you here that are looking for sponsors, please have a shopping list. Don't just get somebody because they got adequate clean time and they sound good at a meeting and look how they're living. Ask yourself, what do you want to be like in them before you seek out their help? And I watched him for 8 months. And I asked this brother, I said, at a Tuesday noon meeting, he was in at the break cleaning out the coffee pot and stuff. And I said, I was sort of like wondering if you could be my sponsor. And he looked at me, he started crying. He said, it would be an honor and a privilege to have you as a part of my life. And no one had ever said that to me. And we embarked upon this journey that we've been on for like the last 6 or 7 years. I need to tell you, my track record with sponsors up until that point was dismal. You could sponsor me to the 4-step only. So I firmly believe that our steps are the key to longevity, happiness, and freedom. They are the key. My pattern up until that point had been, we'll do the first 3. When we get to 4, either I'm going to not be available or I'm going to make it so hard for you to be available in my life that we split up. And that was my distinctive pattern. I never told this man that because we hadn't had a chance to. I never told him anything, actually, up to that point. And he says to me, I want you to write down what the first 3 steps mean to you in your life and how you apply them to your life. He says, when you hand me that, we will start on the 4th step. And I was at a point in my life, man, where the anger was just like cancerous. It was eating me alive. And one of the things that drew me to Marshall was his gentle spirit. Like, I listened to him for 8 months, man. He talked about some heavy stuff, but his demeanor never changed. And he always talks about a loving God, a loving God, a loving God. Any conversation till today that we have always has loving God in there. I can rely on that in him. And we embarked upon this journey. I wrote down stuff in my 4th step that I swore to God I was going to take to my grave. And I said, when I share with this man, I'm going to watch him. If he moves the wrong way, if he flinches when I tell him something, I'm shutting down. Didn't happen. This man has continued to show me love, compassion, empathy, understanding, commitment. I can only, from this point, give you my interpretation of the 12 steps and how I apply them in my life. If you want your own, get it. If you're walking around with somebody else's idea of how the 12 steps work, you're going to be lost. You better embark upon this journey for yourself. first step talks about being powerless over our addiction. Our lives have become unmanageable. And yes, in the beginning, it means drugs. And yes, it better mean drugs. But as you stay around this fellowship long enough, if it's just drugs, you will use again. The disease manifests itself in our behaviors and in our attitudes. That's it. The drugs were a vehicle that was available. You put the drug down, and you're left with you. I believe that the most power that God ever gave me in my life was the first step, because within that first step, he gave me the power of choice. Like, I choose what path I'm on every day. I choose that if something I'm doing is not working, whether to continue to do it or to do something different. Now, if you believe that you're powerless over your disease and your life has become unmanageable, then the second step should not be such a hard thing for most people, but it is. Because it talks about restoration to sanity. Like, you better get a hold of what we did to get high was completely insane. Like, normal people don't steal their own stuff and report it stolen to the police. Like, normal people don't leave a business meeting thinking, I'm going to kill that son of a gun because he didn't agree with me with my vote, and he said he would. Like, normal people don't go to meetings shopping for significant others. Like, normal people don't utilize NA money as a personal ATM fund. Like, normal people, okay? So, is there a need for restoration of sanity? You better believe it. And how does God work? Through us. The second step compels you to have relationships with other people. If you want to run an idea by somebody, pick somebody who's got some sense. Do not go to an angry person trying to find some peace. Do not go to a person that has six different partners and talk about fidelity. They can't help you. The second step leaves a void. I had a sponsor ask me, why do addicts, when they get to anniversaries, why are they crazy? Because, I mean, a lot of addicts claim that right around my anniversary time, I start thinking all crazy and stuff get all crazy. And it dawned on me, that day is a double-edged sword. It's the end for us for one of the longest relationships we ever had, which is with active addiction. So you're mourning that loss. But you're also celebrating the life of recovery in the same day. That's difficult. Third step is a beautiful step because that's when your power manifests itself. When you can make a choice to turn your will and life over to the care of God as you understand him. And we get mad because he allows us to take it back. See, choice is about freedom. Choice is about, see, I heard addicts share about, well, you know, I'm losing my car and I'm getting fired. Why is God doing this to me? You need to take a look at what part you play. If you haven't made your car payments, it's not God's job to pay your car note. If you're going to work late telling your boss what you ain't going to do, it's not God's responsibility to keep your job. The first three steps are what they call the foundation of our recovery. Understand that foundation, that means you plan on building more. I am personally sick of addicts who talk about the first three steps in exclusivity. This is a 12-step program. If all you build is a foundation, you better be in one of them tropical areas where it never rains and the wind never blows and nothing ever happens beyond that foundation, because the minute something comes along, it's going to blow you off your nice foundation. See, the fourth step is that searching and fearless moral inventory, like finding out what part you play in whatever event has happened in your life, because I found out that 95% of the time, I was not a victim. I made bad choices. And let me tell you something. You make choices by either acting or not acting. Don't ever get that twisted. See, when a situation develops in your life, you are offered a list of options. Through our apathy and our fear, options drop off one by one. And we're left with this or that. And then we got the nerve to complain about what our choices are. I come to find out that a choice is not two things. That's an ultimatum. A choice has to have three selections or more. So I'm learning how in this process in my life that when a solution is presented, that I don't wait so long that it's the last one available. Like, what do you do if that doesn't work? The fifth step talks about sharing that fearless and moral inventory. And it's not a right or wrong thing. It's about accountability. And then you share it with that person intimately, and you build on a relationship with a sponsor. It is strongly suggested in our text that you use an NA sponsor to share your fourth step with. Do not share it with your significant other. Do not share it with your therapist. Do not share it with your barber. Share it with someone who can give you direction on what to do next. The sixth step talks about character defects. My favorite. See, it took me a long time to realize that my reactions in the extreme make me defective. Not the feeling or the response to it. Like, fear is a natural way that we protect ourselves from doing stupid things. Like, if you're afraid of getting hit, you watch the traffic light. That's a natural, healthy fear. Okay? Like, sanity is not the absence of fear. It's the presence of insanity. Okay? Like, I'm only in extreme when it's the only way I respond. It took me a long time to realize that my character is in defect when I am in the extreme. Like, it's okay to be angry. You know, because addicts are running around here believing that if I do it in 6 and 7 steps, God's going to remove all this stuff from me. Then who are you going to be? Nothing. You'll lose the ability to emote. See, if I'm angry and I say I'm angry, I no longer have to act like I'm angry. That's the freedom in the 7th step. The 7th step offers you a solution to minimize the behavior tied in to the feeling. Like the 7th step, my sponsor had me in the 6th step take the 48 character defects he gave me, plus the 5 and 6 I discovered were not on that list. And he had me write what the defect does to my life and what I think my life will be like without it. Because you need to have a direction to go in. If you're going to talk about not being spiteful, what you going to feel it with? So you need to have an idea of where you're going. Then you can maybe take that same list in the 7th step and find 2 exact opposites of each character defect. And those were spiritual releases for the behavior. And if you do these things thoroughly, you know when you get to the 8th step, making that list is not that hard because you know you don't harm some people. This is not an exclusive disease. Anybody who comes in contact with our behavior, whether we're active or clean, and acting like we're active, it affects people. So that amends list is necessary. And yes, you need to put your name up there. Because our reading talked about most of all, we harmed ourselves. You know, it also talks about through our inability to accept personal responsibilities, we create our own problems. So once you know there's a problem and you do nothing, now the problem gets worse. The 9th step talks about making amends wherever possible, except when they do so with injuring them or others. Here's the key. Please do not go from 4 to 9, from 1 to 9. From 5 to 9, they are in order for a reason. And before you make the amends, talk to your sponsor. Tell them what the plan of action is. Tell them how you plan on making the amends. If you stole your grandmama's TV 10 years ago and she done made peace with the fact that she don't know who stole her TV, don't tell your grandmama you stole her television. That's insane. We have no right to put people through that kind of pain again. Okay, I did my first 9th step after hearing about it at an NA meeting. I was working on my first step at the time. And I went home to my then wife and told her everything. I believe that was the beginning of the end. I called my sponsor up because I was feeling proud of myself, you know? And I was like, hey, Al, I did a nice step. And I could hear the silence on the other end of the phone. He was like, why? Except when to do so would injure them or others. We are other. We are other. Some of the amends I make are quiet, behind-the-scenes stuff. Like, the best amend you can ever make to anybody you ever harmed is to stay clean, because you have a chance of changing behavior. Okay? The 10-step talks about a personal inventory on a daily basis, pretty much. Like, assess where you are, how you're feeling, what you're doing to maintain your recovery and your constant contact with a loving God. Steps 1 through 3 get you enough courage to get here. 4 through 10 clears the wreckage. Because the 11th step asks for something real specific. That you ask only for God's will and the power to carry that out. Only means without exception. Like, you get past that point when you start asking God for the car and the significant other and the good job and Lord, don't let them catch me from that robbery I did 10 years ago. Don't let my past come up and catch me. Don't let child support come and get me. All that stuff. You stop praying for that stuff. And you start asking God, what can I do to repay you for where you have me now? This is not a selfish program. It's a selfless program. It doesn't mean we think about ourselves less. Okay? So we think about others more. Okay? The idea of being in this fellowship, like, I have seen instances where addicts talked about feeling like a family and love and respect and dignity, and then they leave the meeting and it's raining and there's an addict at the bus stop and everybody going by the addict. But you want to share about how giving you are, but a ride seems to be out of your capacity. See, having had a spiritual awakening, that means that the only way our spirit fully awakens enough for us to serve a loving God in Narcotics Anonymous is through the 12 steps. Don't ever get that twisted. You cannot carry a message if you're still burning in a mess. Can't do it. You can't do it. We carry this message to addicts and practice these principles in all. Once again, all means without exception, our affairs. Now, that's the practice part. Like, I'm not always spiritual. I don't float. I ain't no guru. Okay? There are days you don't want to know me. There are days when my fiance asks me, did you call your sponsor? And every time she's done it, I needed to call my sponsor. The programming committee, as well as the other committees of this convention, have done a phenomenal job in the sense of you might not clap after this part, though. In the sense of, like, the service work. See, there's a misconception going around in Narcotics Anonymous, not just in this area, but as a fellowship, okay? Like, we need to stop candy coating this process. We need to stop allowing addicts to pick and choose what part they want to play in Narcotics Anonymous or what they're willing to do to get this thing. Like, we cannot make it okay for you to take a commitment and decide to show up twice in a one-month period. That's not how we roll. Okay? We need to make it not okay for you to go into a meeting with your cell phone on. I know you're important. Trust me. But you are no more important than the message that's being shared in the Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Please stop using the phrase 13th step. For two reasons. Number one, our original concept, we had 13 steps. And the 13th step was God help us. Okay? And if you are skulking a newcomer, you are not saying God help us. You may call out God at some point in time, but it won't be help us. Please stop believing that anything you do makes you more important than anybody else in here. I need to tell you that all weekend, every time I tried to go down to the mezzanine and hit the balcony and have a moment, God sent somebody. All weekend. All weekend. And I told my fiance when I came back the third time, before I tried to pray before I came up here. I said, I surrender. Because I'm supposed to meet these people that he has on my path. Our traditions are here so we can serve each other. And if you are ever in a situation where you're wondering what's really happening, throw this question in the mix and watch what happens. How is this serving the sick and suffering addict? Keep that thought in mind to the best of your ability, and you will cut through half of the mess that we go through to serve. If you think it's easy doing this, volunteer. Okay? If H&I is hurting in your area, but you're talking about carrying the message, but you ain't got time for our commitment, keep coming. If you think this stuff works by magic, that you can just show up and hang out with somebody that's got 35 years and hope it rubs off on you, keep coming. If you think I'm going to give you my God, you really need to keep coming. Okay? This is my personal relationship with a loving God. Okay? I don't know where I'm going on this path. I'm going to let you know that there's some healing that has been happening in my life. I'm at a place where I'm starting to recognize I deserve love. I can embrace it and not be afraid it's going to leave me. I'm at a place in my life, man, where I realize the mistakes I made in my first marriage and that I have an option of not making them in my second one. You know what I'm saying? I'm realizing that I'm doing some healing of the little boy inside of me that still wants daddy to come by and pick me up off that porch I've been waiting on all day in my best clothes. And he wouldn't show up. That I'm going through that healing process where I'm allowing myself to love him where he is, even though it's difficult, even though it's hard, even though I have expectations. That I need to let him know that I love him. Because my greatest fear for him, he's going to die feeling like he's by himself. And how do I heal that part in me that needs to nurture my son if I don't have that same part being healed with my dad? How do I do that? Late stage recovery for a lot of us is about going back and fixing some stuff that we walked in here with before the disease. I'm going to leave you with this because it becomes apparent to me at times in our life, man, we scratch our head about the people in our life because we all got them difficult people that we deal with. And this is called bits and pieces. People important to you, people unimportant to you, cross your life, touch it with love or carelessness and move on. There are people who leave you and you breathe a sigh of relief and you wonder why you ever came in contact with them. There are people who leave you and you breathe a sigh of remorse and wonder why they had to go away and leave such a gaping hole. Acquaintances move on. People change homes. People grow apart. Enemies hate and move on. Friends love and move on. You think of the many who have moved in your hazy memory. You look on the present and you wonder. I believe in God's master plan in lives. He moves people in and out of each other's lives, and each leaves his mark on the other. You find you are made up of bits and pieces of all who have ever touched your life, and you are more because of it, and you will be less if they had not touched you. Pray God that you accept the bits and pieces in humility, in wonder, and never question their regret. Thanks for letting me share.